belong, become, believe. You're listening to Grace Church of Northwest Arkansas podcast. The message for March 3rd, 2024 is called Tuba Solos. The speaker is John Ray and the location is Central United Methodist Chapel in Fayetteville, Arkansas.
Well, hello again if you're listening on the podcast or on the live stream. My name is John Ray, and we're really glad to have you here at Grace Church of Northwest Arkansas. And also, I just want to say how grateful I am for every one of you for being here. The things that we talk about, the things that we wrestle together about on Sundays and through the weeks, they in many ways keep me alive because I don't know how to process these things by myself. I don't know how to think by myself. I need y'all to help me do that. So thank you for being here. Thank you for showing up. Thank you for enduring through my ramblings at times. But I'm really, really grateful for each one of you. So it's a cool thing living in a university town like we do. The U of A offers the opportunity to engage with a vast variety of people, ideas, and experiences unique to university culture. When Jane and I were first getting to know each other, one of our first dates was to Macbeth at the University Theater on the U of A campus, one of the only places we could afford to go when we were first starting the date with that, and we loved it. There are also some people here on campus, besides our own Dr. Acuff, who, while they may not be recognized in the wider world, are really big deals within their specific area of study. And one of them is Benjamin Pierce. So how many of you have heard of Benjamin Pierce? Okay, got one. What's that? So you may not be familiar with this name, but Pierce is regarded as a pioneer in playing the tuba as a solo instrument. I kid you not. He's won dozens of competitions for his unique arrangements for an instrument usually relegated to the back row and only recognized for its foghorn low sounds, right? But let me tell you, he can play this thing in really creative ways. You need to go listen to some of the things that he's done. They're really creative. It's really fascinating. It gives you a new appreciation for the tuba. And while listening to this and understanding this is novel and it's interesting, I wouldn't want it to become the only thing or even the dominant music that I listen to. Like, I'm not going to just throw out all my other music and only listen to tuba solos. It's just, that would not be a good thing. But something like that has happened when it comes to our modern Western Protestant understanding of salvation. Something like just taking one element of a vast, complex orchestra and history of music and saying, no, this one thing is the thing. And not only is it the thing, it's a predominant, but you should stop listening. You shouldn't listen to anything else besides this. And it's not that the thing itself is necessarily bad or unnecessary. It's just that it's only a part. Well, we'll get into it and see if what I'm saying makes sense. First of all, you know, I want to recap a little bit. We're studying Hebrews. Hebrews was written to an audience that had come to follow Jesus and follow the ways of the apostles, the early church, out of the Judaic tradition. So these were people who were familiar with the analogies and the references to Torah and into Judaism. They were very familiar with that. And so that language this message is steeped in that language with that. Also in stuff that we don't understand, that's not in the Bible but is adjacent to that culture. Kind of the histories and the stories that surrounded what we know as the Old Testament that we're totally unfamiliar with is referenced in this letter. And so it can seem odd or foreign to us at times. The main theme, as we've talked about, is this idea that the author uses this rhetorical device of we have and because we have. Pointing out the things that we're given, primarily through Jesus, and because we have that, this, we should live this way. And then in doing this, they also espouse what Jeff so trippingly came off his tongue earlier, is the Christological hermeneutic, or understanding that Jesus, our understanding of the person of Jesus interprets the rest of the Bible, that we default to Jesus with that. Well, let's read. We're going to read chapter 2 today. And again, some of this is going to be strange. That's okay. Don't feel intimidated by it. You're not, in some ways, you're not meant to get it. It wasn't written to us. This was written to another group of people, very different cultural expectations. That's not to say there's not something for us, as we'll say, but it wasn't written to us. So, verse 1. Therefore, we must pay closer attention to what we have heard so that we do not drift away. That's the thesis of what's going to come. For if the message spoken through the angels proved to be so firm that every vision of disobedience received is just penalty, how will we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? For it was first communicated through the Lord and was confirmed to us by those who heard it, while God confirmed their witness with signs and wonders and various miracles and gifts of the Holy Spirit distributed according to his will. For he did not put... I got to stop here. For he, according to his Holy Spirit... So one of the things that we've talked about is that Priscilla may be the author of this, that we may have a woman author. One of the things that I think is gives us a key to this is right here, this emphasis on the Spirit, the gifts of the Spirit being distributed by the Spirit to whoever. Because this was a sign of the early church, is that no longer were the signs and wonders was God contained within just the priestly class or those who were the gatekeepers of religion, but it's kind of like it just bust open to everybody with that. So, verse 5, for he did not put the world to come about which we are speaking under the control of angels. Instead, someone testified somewhere, and I love that, right? You ever get intimidated when someone says, give me the chapter and verse on that? You're like, I'm not sure somebody somewhere said it. They do that in the Bible. You're good. For someone, let's see, speaking under the control of the angels, somewhere testified, what is man that you think of him or the son of man that you care for him? You made him little lower than the angels for a little while. You crowned him with glory and honor. You put all things under his control. For when he put all things under his control, he left nothing outside his control. At present, we do not yet see all things under his control, but we see Jesus, who is made a little lower than the angels for a little while, now crowned with glory and honor because he suffered death, so that by God's grace, he would experience death on behalf of everyone. For it was fitting for him, for whom and through him all things, I love that when we sing all things, right? For whom and through whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory, to make the pioneer of their salvation perfect through sufferings. For indeed, he who makes holy, and those being made holy, all have the same origin. And so he is not ashamed to call them brothers and sisters, saying, I will proclaim your name to my brothers. In the midst of the assembly, I will praise you. Again, he says, I will be confident in him. And again, here I am with the children God has given me. Therefore, since the children share in the flesh and blood, he likewise shared in their humanity, so that through death he could destroy the one who holds the power of death, that is the devil, and set free those who were held in slavery all their lives by the fear of death. For surely his concern is not angels, but he is concerned for Abraham's descendants. Therefore, he had to be made like one of his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he could become a merciful and faithful high priest in the things relating to God, to make atonement for the sins of the people. For since he himself suffered when he was tempted, he is able to help those who are tempted. Jennifer commented that this is almost like a geometry proof when you're reading it. Because, therefore, that since then, this is... Which is true. There is a cognizant argument being made as to why. The way they make the argument may seem a little foreign to us. There's going to be elements we don't fully understand about this message being proclaimed by the angels and the hierarchy of things that may seem old-fashioned or not relevant, but the structure, I think, stands with that. And the whole idea is that Jesus defeats death. That the ultimate enemy all of us face in this life is the end of this life, is death. And that Jesus overcomes that. And because Jesus overcomes that, we should not neglect that fact. We shouldn't just pass it off. And so as we look at this, as we read it, we need to come to understand that the great enemy is death. And once death is defeated, we are free to live and die still, but with hope. And it's weird how easy this is to lose sight of. We live in a death-denying culture. Ours is the only generation, I would say, starting probably in the 60s, 70s maybe, in the last 50 years, where people didn't die at home. Where the family wouldn't take care of the body of the person that was deceased and have it in their home. Where death wasn't something. Our modern experience is, rarely do we encounter dead people. We may encounter someone in a coffin who's already been made to look pretty, but we don't encounter death. And look, I'm not advocating necessarily that we, you know, go back to where we were, but we need to recognize that this has a very specific effect on how we think about death. We're also in a society that idolizes youth. It idolizes able-bodiedness. It idolizes things that death would sully. We don't want to think about death in the context of these things. We idolize vitality and life, and like I said, able-bodiedness and youth. I mean, in some ways, our economy would probably collapse if there weren't all the things that promise youth being sold out there, right? Everything from gym memberships to makeup to fast cars to, you know, whatever it is. They're all sold on the promise of staving off old age, thus staving off death. And so as a result, we have a very unhealthy relationship with death, and it actually gives it more power. We may not consciously think of it as we go through the day. And this is the thing about it is, if we put it off and we put it off and we don't think about it and we don't have a healthy relationship with it, and then it comes inevitably. Maybe not ours, but someone close to us. And it comes unexpectedly. And it comes too soon. Or it comes in a way that we really don't understand how it came. And then we don't know what to do. We're overwhelmed by it. It goes from being something that we're barely conscious of to all of a sudden something that just dominates us and overwhelms us. And it's not a healthy way to live with that. History is replete with examples of people trying to avoid or overcome death. Most of us learn to repress and ignore it until it's too late. We talked about it. Like, think about how you thought of death as a kid. When was the first time that you became conscious that things die and people die? I don't know about y'all, but as a kid, that scared me. Like, my initial forays with death, there was an ophthalmologist in Austin who was friends of our family, and he had a private pilot's license. And he crashed his plane, killing all his family. And I'll never forget, this was probably my first experience with death, thinking about it. Because I was probably, I'm 6, 7, 8 years old. I was pretty young. And I remember going to the funeral and seeing the caskets, and the caskets were all sized appropriately. So, two adult caskets, and then a child's casket, and then like a really small child's casket. And there were five or six up there. And I could smell the place. I could smell the thing to you, carpet walking in there, seeing that as a kid. And then soon after that, there was a local TV figure who did a children's show, and he died. And I can remember just sobbing, like terrified. Like, how does this happen? What happens when people die? And of course, my mom, my parents were like, you know, they were trying to assuage my fear, you know, talking about Jesus, talking about heaven, talking about these things. But that didn't help at the time. That was something I couldn't comprehend. What I could comprehend is that all of a sudden, people were gone. And they weren't coming back. And that terrified me. But then somewhere along the way, you know, I got to, I don't know if it was the endless church camps and youth group messages that, you know, get you to pray this prayer of salvation so that you know that you don't have to be scared when you die. You don't have to be scared when you die. But if you don't pray this prayer, you need to really be scared when you die. Then I kind of checked it off. I was like, okay, I guess I've prayed the prayer, I've done the thing, so I don't have to worry about it. And then it just kind of left my consciousness for a while. And then through various events that, you know, I've talked about in other places, it came back with a vengeance with that. And death creates a lot of questions. I mean, look, we don't know what happens when we die. We have ideas, we have hints, we have signs, but we don't know. We can't say for certain. There's only one person that we believe who has come back from the dead, and we have the testimony of that, but it's not like we can do a Q&A. You know? It's like we don't really know what's going to happen. And so, because in our society, we don't want to talk about it until we're forced to talk about it, and when we're forced to talk about it, we're really not in a position to honestly talk about it, to dispassionately talk about it, to really think about it in a way that goes, we're just caught in this cycle. We're caught in this cycle. But Jesus overcomes this. I mean, this is a bedrock foundation of our belief, of our followership, is that Jesus overcomes death. That somehow, some way, Jesus, because Jesus died and because Jesus was raised again, we don't have to fear. That's not the same thing as knowing what's going to happen. We just know that we don't have to fear when it comes. And then the author makes this astounding, you know, admonition. Don't neglect that. Don't forget about it. Don't sit with that fact. Or don't neglect to sit with that fact. Don't stop thinking about the way Jesus overcomes death. And then says and gives a warning as to why. And the author says, because if you do, you might wander away as so many have. And I love that, and so many have. I love that description, especially in our society today. What we're seeing is not a whole lot of people who are just like, you know, I used to believe in God, now I don't. I'm adamantly not God, or against God. It's just wandering away. Just like, it's just not important anymore. It's just the better things to do. And I think a lot of it comes back to how we think about death. Now, this is where it's going to get kind of nerdy, but I'm going to go quick with it, okay? So the way that the church has historically thought about this is this idea of how does Jesus overcome death? How did in sin, so it has a little formula. Sin brings death. Jesus overcomes death and sin, okay? These are called theories of atonement. They're the theories of how that happens. And this is where we get to the tuba part. Is so there's within the Christian or the Protestant church, predominantly the Western Protestant church, there are seven main theories of atonement. And I'm just going to name them. I've linked an article in the learning guide that describes them all in more detail, and I encourage you to read them. But I'm not going to go into detail about all of them. I just want to kind of make us familiar. There's the ransom theory, that Jesus pays the ransom for us so that we're saved. There's recapitulation theory, which means Jesus does what we couldn't do. Jesus steps in and basically does it for us with that, redoes it and does it right. There's satisfaction series or theory, which is that God is offended by our sin, by our disobedience, and Jesus kind of steps in and gives satisfaction to God. That, and this is an old term, right? And if you study these, you'll see how they're all culturally bound. They all come out of a specific time and culture as to what was important in that culture at the time. There's penal substitution, which is that, hey, you're guilty of something, you can't pay the price, God steps in, pays the price, and then that is imputed to us. That payment is imputed to us, so we're no longer in debt or obligated to do that. There's the moral example. Jesus shows us how to live. We've lost the knowledge of how to live. Jesus shows us how to live. There's the Christus Victor, which is the idea what talks about, really here you see a lot of Christus Victor, with Jesus overcoming dark evil forces that have held us in bondage, that caused death. And then there's Christian Universalism, which is not universalism like the Unitarian Universalist, but it's more universalism in the sense that in the places where it says that this salvation is for everybody. It genuinely is for everybody. Like, everybody's got it. It's there. It's already done. It's for everybody. As I've studied these, and I've probably studied these more than is good for a person at times, I've added two of my own with this that I think if there were more modern writers, one is attachment theory, atonement theology, which deals with emotional attachment and detachment. With that, I think there's a definite element that we could see in the Gospels of Jesus using attachment theory to bring us back. I think there's also one, I had a professor, Larry Skelton, or Shelton in seminary, who his was heart transplant. It was Jesus takes our heart out, our heart of stone, as it's talked about in the Old Testament, gives us a heart of flesh. Like we get a literal heart transplant. That's the way that we're saved. Okay, so all these things. Here's the thing. All of these, you could argue all of these things. In a way, they're all true. And one of the things I think that helps us is to understand them as kind of an orchestra. Is that no single one of them adequately does everything. They all work together. There's an element of truth in all of them, and there's discrepancies in all of them. Some things that they don't need to speak, they can't speak to. They don't have the bandwidth, or they don't have the range to talk to. That this one can talk to this, but it can't talk to that, and this one can speak to this, but it doesn't do these. And these two, when you do them together, man, it's even better when they're together. They sound even better, but if you play them apart, it's kind of tinny, or it's kind of low, or we kind of don't get it. Like, they all speak together. They all play together. But in our society, which one of these, not to put anybody on the spot, but which one of these has become kind of the tuba solo that wants to dominate and wants to play the whole song and doesn't want anybody else to play? Anybody want to venture a guess? It's penal substitution. And this comes out of the Reformation. It comes out of a neo-reform deal, but it is. This is the fundamentalist evangelical thing. This is, when you memorized the four spiritual laws when you were in Campus Crusade or STUMO, it was all about penal substitution. That was the theory. And there are whole denominations and churches and strands of history, of church right now, that will tell you, if you do not believe in penal substitution, if you believe in any of these other atonement theories, you're flat out not a Christian. Which, again, is just like, okay, I get it. You like your tuba. The tuba's awesome, but there are other instruments out there that we can play. And the tuba actually is best when it's not a solo. Like, yeah, every once in a while, in the rare blue moon, there may be a time for the tuba solo, but most of the time, we need all the other things. And honestly, any one of these others does a better solo than that at times and in places. But again, the thing is, they all go together. Now, why do I say all this? N.T. Wright talks about how in these passages, and later on in Hebrews, the reader is being encouraged not just to stick with what they've got, rather than abandoning it, but that they also must pay closer attention. They must go deeper into the truth and life, which is theirs because they belong to the Messiah. And Alex made a comment, which I thought was interesting, is it's not like the only way we're going to go forward is to go deeper as a church, as people in our faith. And I kind of expressed this at the first when I really am grateful, but I'm grateful because I've got to go deeper if I'm going to stick with this thing. And we've talked about this. We talked about why, you know, if you're coming to Grace Church, if you're listening to these podcasts, you're probably looking for a reason and you want a place to grow. You want a place to be. And we want it to be that place because we have to be that place. Like, we're not going to make it if we don't go deeper. If we neglect these things, if we just take them at superficial surface value, we're going to wander away, y'all. It's just going to happen. It's just what happens. Often it's not a conscientious choice. It just, you kind of think you know it. You kind of become, not to belabor the illustration, but you kind of become content with the tuba. And you're like, I know all there is to know about the tuba. I've heard the tuba solo before. I know all the tuba solos. And you just naturally wander off to something else because there's so much more out there. Y'all, we need to go deeper. We need to understand this incredible symphony of salvation that Jesus has provided that overcomes even death. That's an unbelievable thing that we get to do. There's nothing that is more important in some ways than this, than understanding what we have. And because we have, we get the chance to go deeper into these things. So Alex and Jeff are going to come back up and take some time to just reflect on this a little bit, and then we'll sing, and then we'll do communion like we've been doing. We'll take it and all hold the elements and then take them together, and then Ryan will give us our benediction as we go. But thank you again, seriously, for being here and for wrestling these things and being willing to go deeper.
Thank you for listening to Grace Church of Northwest Arkansas podcast.
If you would like to give, you can go to gracechurchnwa.org/give.
You can find more about us online at gracechurchnwa.org. Grace and peace.